Welcome to Inspiring Stories for Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments because the little things are everything.
Hello, my name is Tim McMillan. Welcome to another episode of Inspiring Stories brought to you by Bauer and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments as the little things are everything. In this episode, you're going to meet someone who's had a truly adventurous life, a very Australian way of life, and one that few of us, I dare say, can truly comprehend, one that most of us might only have read about or seen on a screen, a story that starts in the harshest and most remote parts of the Australian outback. My guest became a lawyer and worked on the infamous Lindy Chamberlain case, and later found herself working in Europe, mostly in Prague, during a time of huge upheaval in the Czech Republic. Also spent many years living in Western Australia as well. She's released a number of books based on her life stories. But for the time being, we're going to hear those stories straight from the author herself. So hello and welcome to Tanya Heaslip. Hello, Tanya. How are you?
Hello, Tim. What a wonderful introduction. Thank you.
It seems like a little amount of detail to encapsulate what has been a pretty adventurous life. So I'm sure I skipped over a lot there, but we'll try to fill in some of those blanks over the next hour or so.
Thank you.
Let's go back to your early days. I'm fascinated by life in the outback. It almost seems so Australian and yet so quirky to people who, you know, grow up and live in a big city. You grew up really, if there is a middle of nowhere in Australia, that's where you grew up, right? In the outback of Northern Territory. Can you paint a picture for us, just what it was like there?
Central Australia, the heart of Australia and the heart of the outback. So this is the 60s and the early 70s, and it is hundreds and hundreds of miles of nowhere. It's semi-arid, surrounded by arid witches, defined as desert, hundreds of miles of nothing. So this land, to me, was all I knew. And for bush kids, it is all they know. And it's this most wonderful playground. So you can imagine the former inland sea, which is what Central Australia is, red, red, red dirt, these magnificent old folded McDonald ranges, gullies, upside down creeks. So all our creeks are white sand with the river running underneath, and, you know, nine inch rainfall, whatever that is now in millimetres, not much. And it was cattle. So that's what Central Australia, industry. There was no sheep. That, in fact, some people tried sheep in the early days of pioneering, but the dingoes soon put pay to that. So cattle, Pole Hereford, which are a British breed, but remarkably they do well in even 45 degrees summer and, of course, cope during the desert winters, which at night are freezing and below zero. So this red, wild land of white gum trees and huge blue skies, not dissimilar in some ways to the Pilbara, just was a magic playground. And we lived on horses. We spent all our childhood mustering cattle because the children on a cattle station are the reliable base workforce. The stockmen would come and go. Many of them were drifters, you know, back in those days. But we kids were there, and so we had to learn to work cattle, work yards, fix fences, fix boars. We were little men doing big men's work, and it was completely normal for school to be put aside and us to be sent out into stock camp for sometimes 3 weeks at a time, because the priority was all around cattle and getting the cattle to market. So that really was the life, with a little bit of school thrown in for luck.
Well, you obviously made the most of that brief amount of school that you had, Tanya. I have to ask, though, how on earth did your family end up trying to make something of this incredibly harsh terrain?
Oh, you know, that is such a good question. They were pioneers, I think, without realising it. So they were both from the Flinders Ranges in South Australia, which was sheep country, saltbush sheep country. Mum wanted adventure. She wanted to escape the conservative South Australian country town life that she'd grown up with. And so she went to Alice Springs and worked as a governess on a cattle station in 1957, which back then was like going to the other side of the world. And her mother wept and the entire town said she'd be murdered and never seen again. Anyhow, she just had the best time of her life. She loved the freedom, this space. And up there, the territory was just full of people who'd come and everyone was accepted. They'd come from all parts of Australia. And so she went back, and when Dad, they were childhood sweethearts, when he persuaded her to marry him, she said, on the condition we go back to the territory. So that was the deal. And what they did then was start looking for properties, but they were just a young couple. There was a 10-year drought in Central Australia in the late 50s and early 60s. And then miraculously this little block, which is what we lived on, came up, and it was going cheap because of the drought. They bought it on under the most disadvantageous terms, 3 years of putting into the property, and at the end, if they hadn't met the government's conditions that would have been taken from them, they would have received nothing in return. It's a pastoral lease, so almost no security there whatsoever. But they came age 26 by then with three children under four. Wow. Took up this little block, and they still had sheep in South Australia. So for the first years of my life, we were shuttled sort of 1,000 miles north and south while they made a go of this little block.
I understand Dad was quite a tough customer.
Dad was very tough. He came from a long line of Irish peasants that had escaped the potato famine in Ireland, and we were never allowed to forget how lucky we all were that we had potatoes, we had food, and his forebears came out and they took up land in South Australia, and they were Methodists, so good God-fearing people, and their motto was work. Work, 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 and church on Sunday. So we just grew up with this mantra of work, and we knew nothing else. I mean, we didn't have holidays. If there were holidays, they were spent in the stock camp. And he walked around with a stock whip and he'd crack it with good effect. Kids would go running. If we were misbehaving, just one look towards the stock whip would do the trick. He was a very tough man, and he took on this land in the territory, and everyone said he'd fail because he knew nothing of cattle and it was the middle of a drought. But he was a very astute businessman, and he realised quickly he needed to learn how to work the land and then to innovate. So he, before many other people did, he was putting in fences and he was putting in extra stockyards and sinking bores and always living on the edge of the mortgage, of the overdraft. So money was constantly tight, and there was just always that fear that we could lose everything. So he worked harder than anyone and drove us all.
You mentioned that you didn't get to spend a lot of time at school or focus on your education, and yet you've been held up as a bit of a poster child, if you like, or a poster person for School of the Air, which is a fantastic institution in Australia. Tell me how it worked for you. I mean, how often did you actually get to sit down?
Well, back when I was studying, and when we did get into the schoolroom, this little stone room just off the homestead, me, my sister and my brother and a long-suffering governess, because Mum was inside cooking beef for about 20, 30 stockmen at any sitting, we did work. When we studied, it was from 7:30 in the morning until 1. And that was correspondence lessons. And they came up on the GAN, the train from Adelaide, in fortnightly packs. And so the governess helped us. We learned our three R's, basically, reading, writing, arithmetic, in written form. And then we'd send them back. It might be, a month, 2 months before we got the results back, and we'd eagerly wait to see if we'd got a gold star or dreaded the red pen and tried to remember what we'd learnt before. And that was a very good grounding because it covered everything, even if it was just in written form. But the exciting thing for half an hour each day was School of the Air. And even if we missed out on our correspondence lessons, I in particular almost always, unless I was on the back of a horse, got in front of that microphone because it just took me into this magical world, this other place of a voice of a teacher and the voice of students from other cattle stations. I didn't know what they looked like, but I painted faces around their voices. And it was pure theatre because we couldn't see each other and we didn't all have the same books, but the school of the year teacher would, you know, make us do our sums on over the radio, and then we'd read out of books, and then sometimes she would post out to us all a play, and then we'd all take turns. So you'd have all these kids calling in through the static. Good morning, Mrs. Hodder. This is Tanya from Sierra Vista Uniform. I'm here with my poem. I can read you loud and clear. Over. And there were lots of overs. You'd have all these kids' voices diving in through the static, and it was just the most wonderful way of engaging with something bigger than this very isolated world that I had at home, because it was just my family and the stockman, and our friends were the dogs and a Joey and, you know, a little potty calf and our horses. But this gave me entree to another world. And the teacher we had, Mrs. Hodder, really encouraged me. I think she saw that I was a very bookish child and that I longed for these outlets. So every time Mum went into town for stores, which was once a month, she would go to School of the Air, and Mrs. Hodder, the teacher, would give her a big box of books from the library and bring back to me. So I spent every spare moment I had with my nose in a School of the Air storybook.
And as I mentioned, a star graduate of School of the Air, apparently the first person to go through a School of the Air program and to go on and graduate as a lawyer. And as a lawyer, one of your early big cases was working on the Lindy Chamberlain case, which has just been one of the most enduring stories in modern Australian history. I'll get you to talk us through your involvement in that, Tanya, right after we take a break. This is Inspiring Stories. Tanya Heaslip is our special guest. We'll be back with more in a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. We are speaking to published author Tanya Heaslip about her many, many life adventures. Tanya, I just mentioned before the break, you graduated from the School of Air, the first person to go through that program to go on to attain a law degree. Your first big case as a junior solicitor, the Lindy Chamberlain case. That's a big one.
A huge one. It was such a contrast going from a School of the Air student into something like, I mean, obviously there was secondary school and university, but it seemed like a huge leap, and at the same time it seemed entirely appropriate that my very first gig should be an event that had happened just south of Alice Springs, where I grew up. I'd begun as a junior solicitor for the Crown. I was very homesick after boarding school and law school. I really wanted to come home. And so I went to Darwin, and this very unfortunate tourist fell off Ayers Rock, as it was called then, Yulara, and died. And they found Lindy Chamberlain's, Azaria Chamberlain, sorry, his matinee jacket at right next to the body. As a result, Lindy was let out of jail immediately, because she'd always maintained Azaria was wearing this matinee jacket. So the Territory Government scrambled to pull together an inquiry, and they needed, you know, bodies on it. So the Crown got back the original team that had done the trial and the appeals, but the solicitor who'd run it had a whole raft of other issues he was dealing with, and he said, I need a junior. So they looked around, who are the new kids on the block? And I just started doing little court cases, and I thought it was marvellous, and I wasn't interested in going into some, you know, big inquiry that I didn't really understand. And the Solicitor General at the time said to me, young lady, if you don't do this, I'll make sure you never practice in the Territory again. So back then, you know, you didn't have much choice. So for 18 months, I was the junior instructing solicitor for the Crown as the inquiry moved its way from Darwin to Alice to Ayers Rock, Yulara, and then on to Sydney and Melbourne. And it was quite extraordinary, because the Crown was defending its position, in the sense it was on the back foot for the inquiry. And I saw firsthand just what it was like to have that precious question of justice trampled on. It's been very interesting in recent times with the with little Cleo and seeing how people's reactions can be divided about these kinds of issues. And we were like a travelling circus. The media was embedded. There were a squillion people supporting Lindy's team. She had a lot of supporters as well as her legal team. There was the Crown. And this question of justice just went back and forth. And I realised as I was working 24/7 supporting, you know, this incredible legal team that, in fact, Lindy had been wrongly convicted. Mm. She should never have been convicted, and the jury hadn't believed her and the forensic evidence was flawed combined. She was sent to jail and she never should have been. So that really opened my eyes to trial by media. It was the first trial by media in Australia. How easy it is for public opinion to be swayed by, you know, prejudice. And Lindy received every kind of prejudicial attack you could have imagined. And then the power of people who push for truth and justice. And, of course, her team were on the other side to us, but they bit by bit unravelled the Crown's case and demonstrated that Lindy and Michael should never have been convicted. So I learned the most enormous amount. I also made some wonderful friends with the journalists, and it was interesting. The media team were also split into sort of three camps, really, pro, against, and in the middle. And so I talked to them all and I learnt a lot. I must say, I think that ruined me for general practice after that, because working in that kind of pressure, it was the first kind of inquiry of its kind. Going to wills and fence disputes with neighbours just didn't quite have the same adrenaline kick. But it was extraordinary, and I sat, I don't know, a couple of metres away from Lindy Chamberlain every single day for 18 months, and she had enormous presence and a great sort of sense of reserve. I would often pinch myself and think, I'm here in the middle of this case that's changing history. History is really being changed before my eyes, because it was clear that the law would have to change as a result.
Did you have a sense of the enormity of it at the time, or is that something that's just sunk in the many years since?
I think in the years since, I've become increasingly aware of the enormity. At the time, you know, I was just out. Mm. I had my little yellow telegram from the Chief Minister of the Territory saying, congratulations on being the first school of the air student to graduate in law. And I was just full of adrenaline myself and the excitement of it all. And also I worked phenomenally hard because the pressure on our team was enormous, and the amount of evidence we had to deal with was enormous. So much of my time was just focused on the dailiness of ensuring I kept everything up to my masters. But it did occur to me as time went on, because I would listen and talk to the people on the other side and to the media especially. And so by the end, I think I had a real sense. But the enormity has come later.
Do you know, Tony, I was lucky enough to go and cover the final inquest for Lindy Chamberlain up in Darwin. I think, if my memory serves, about 2012, for, I suppose, what was a final declaration of innocence, if you like. So it's taken long.
Yes. That's, you know, decades. Mm. Decades she has had to labour under these antiquated laws and the injustices that she suffered, and the loss of her marriage, and just it's unthinkable actually what she went through and how long it took for justice to be served.
Were you always absolutely convinced that that the Chamberlains had nothing to do with it, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, growing up in the outback, I knew very well what dingoes could do. Mm. But we'd be in the stock camp and the dingoes would come and sniff around our camp at night. They'd be looking for food. They were hungry wild dogs and they'd scavenge. And we knew that there was a real problem at Ayers Rock because tourists were increasingly leaving litter and food around the campsites and the dingoes were coming into the campsites. So I knew without a doubt a dingo could do it. There was no doubt in my mind a dingo was capable of doing it.
Yeah. Let's fast forward now I'm guessing there was a real sense of itchy feet. You've decided I'm going to say goodbye to Australia for a little while, pack my bags, I'm heading off to Europe. Was that your first big trip overseas?
It was. I'd wanted to go overseas ever since I'd read my School of the Air storybooks that Mrs. Hodder sent me. All the Enid Blyton children having adventures across meadows and down to Smuggler's Cove and this place called England that I just thought sounded magical. Heidi going up her Swiss mountain. You know, these stories had presented to me an overseas continent I was very hungry to visit. But it took me a long time. I finished Chandler and I kept working. Then in 1989, I said, that's it, I'm going. I had a broken heart. There's nothing like a broken heart to absolutely catapult you into action and say, right, I'm heading off. So that's and I backpacked on my own all around Western Europe. And my poor mother, I think back now, God, I had those little cards you could get at the back and you'd go into the telephone box and you'd call reverse charges home. And I think poor mum, it was just so traumatic. But I had the most extraordinary adventure for that year, and I loved every bit of it. And can I just say what happened at the end of it?
Sure.
So I was in a pub in London about to come home with a great friend of mine. And we were having last drinks. You know, remember the Qantas round the world ticket of mine, 12 months, yep, had just about expired. And the television was on and there was this almighty ruckus. And I said, what is going on, Michael? And he said, oh, it's the Berlin Wall. And the Berlin Wall was falling and nobody had believed that could happen. And again, it was that sense of history and legal systems are being rewritten before my eyes. And I said to Michael, we've got to get there. And we got the two last seats on a flight full of media into Berlin the next day, and I saw with my own eyes people streaming through Checkpoint Charlie, the hugs, the tears, the disbelief. I had an East German soldier hack me off a bit of wall. He was standing there with, you know, it's hobnail boots with no job to do, nowhere to go.
There are so many bits of the wall scattered around the world. Are you sure?
I know, so I got that and I thought, right, now I've got to go back because I was totally broke. I've got to go back and do some more law, and then as soon as I can, I want to see what's on the other side of this wall.
Yeah. And so you went back, and of all places, you end up in Prague. I mean, it's a stunning place, but it's not the first place that people think of going to. How on earth did you end up in Prague of all of the options?
Of all of the options, especially, this was 1994 that I went. You know, there was no Google. There was no computer. There was a map, you know, a map of this country I'd barely ever heard of. I came back to Australia and I kept practising law and I kept dreaming about getting over that wall and seeing what was on the other side. What had communism been like? And I must confess, I'd probably watched one too many James Bond movies and I found the whole idea of getting across to the other side just so close after the wall had fallen to see what was there, you know, very enticing. Long story short, I found a barrister who'd been there. He was in the territory. He got me a job in a little town called Sedlčany in the Czech Republic. Mm-hmm. Long story to how he knew it, but he said, I'll get you this job. And I said, yes, I would be teaching English to high school students. Now, I knew nothing about the Czech Republic or it was Czechoslovakia. It just became the Czech Republic when I went there in 94. I knew nothing about teaching, English, but I thought, this is an adventure. I can't say no. I will figure it out as I go. So I jumped and I ended up in this little town, which was something out of George Orwell's time. You know, time had stood still in this place and the communist regime was still alive and well, even 4 years after it fallen, and I was treated with enormous suspicion on arrival, you know, Westerner and the only Western person in the town. But I had an amazing time there in the end. The students really embraced me and I taught them lots of, you know, Australian songs like Waltzing Matilda, and we had so much fun. And then through them I ran into, by chance, two Czech Australians, Czech people who now lived in Australia. They'd returned because communism had fallen. They were just in a country town near me and they said, you've got to come to Prague. It's so beautiful. And I barely knew that Prague existed because I was in this you know, settle Charni, this tiny place cut off from the rest of the world. And they said, no, you must come. So they took me, and that was the start of it. I thought, oh, this is the most beautiful city I've ever seen, and it's straight out of my childhood storybooks, and I'm staying.
And from all of those images that had formed in your mind as a child reading books and having this romantic picture of what Europe would be like, it sounds like Prague was the place that lived up to those images that you'd had all through your childhood. Is that a fair thing?
That is absolutely right. I never actually thought such a thing could happen, but when I walked into Staroměstské náměstí, the old town square, I felt like Alice falling through the rabbit hole. It was the most extraordinary feeling. I've never experienced anything like it before or since. I felt like I was inside a Grimm's fairy tale or inside one of my storybooks. It was like a movie set. I thought, this can't be real, but it was real, this, you know, 11th century old city. So it was all and more that I could have imagined. So beautiful.
And you've dedicated one of your books, Alice to Prague, entirely on that adventure, and it sounds magical. So just before we go to another break, Tanya, I have to ask, why did you leave?
Another broken heart. I had this amazing time. I taught judges of the High Court and the Minister of Justice and the Head of International Relations English. I created this legal English consultancy, and I could have stayed there forever, but it was actually very difficult. I was broke. The working as an expat there, even though I was working with the Czech people one-on-one, was, you know, I think I got $26 a month, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, and I had a mortgage back in Australia, and bit by bit it was not being paid. But I fell in love with a Czech man with blue eyes, and he quoted poetry under the moon and played guitar, and I thought, I will stay here forever. But in the end, I did come to realise that it probably wouldn't last. And the city was a fairy tale, and my life there was fairy tale in many respects, but I also realised I could never actually fully be the person that I'd trained to be back in Australia. I could never fully practice law, and the language was incredibly difficult. So all those sort of reasons came to a head after about 2.5 years. And I came back to Australia, but I kept thinking I would return, and I went back over and over again. I've been back so many times. I still love it almost as much as ever.
It's still a stunning place, but broken-hearted, two good reasons, I suppose, to seek a new adventure. We'll take another break, Tanya, if you don't mind. After that, we'll talk about your adventures in Western Australia, another chapter in your incredible life. This is Inspiring Stories. Tanya Heaslip is my special guest. Back with more after this.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. Tim McMillan is my name. My special guest is published author multiple times in Tanya Heaslip. We're hearing about her many, many life adventures. Saying goodbye to Prague, Tanya. Sometime after that, you find yourself for the next chapter in the Wild West, Western Australia. What brought you to Western Australia? Again, of all the places that you could seek new pastures around the world, Western Australia was it.
Yeah. Again, and I think this has happened throughout my life, the right person at the right time. So I'd come back from Prague. I was very brokenhearted. I was back into my old law firm in the Territory, listening to Smetana and Dvořák and the other beautiful Czech composers at night, and weeping for this land and this culture I'd left behind, and thinking, why am I back, you know, dealing with DUIs and, you know, all the other tiresome legal issues, sorting out people's problems. And I met a colleague who had done some work with me in the Territory on some land rights cases. So because I'd grown up there and I had that connection with the land and a lot of people on the land, I also did a lot of land rights type work. And this colleague of mine had started in WMC in Perth. And she said to me, look, you should come across to the West. There's lots of this work, and it would be, you know, exciting. And I was so unsettled, and I thought I do need a new adventure. So I went for 3 months. I just jumped again. Again, my career seems to comprise of a lot of jumping without much forethought. I ended up on a couch in somebody's room in Innaloo, and then did this 3 month contract at WMC assisting. It was just after the WIC decision came down. You might remember the High Court decision, which looked at the interaction of pastoral rights and native title rights. So because of my background, I worked on that, and that contract ended. But then essentially I was headhunted into what it's still the Chamber of Minerals and Energy to work on what was known as the WIC 10-point plan that was put forward by the Howard government at the time, and WA was looking to shore up its interests. So just from the sublime to the ridiculous, suddenly I'm back on a plane every second week to Canberra, part of this lobbying team. So it was a little similar to Chamberlain in the sense that suddenly it was involved the media, and there was politics, and it was law, and it was a whole new world, and Canberra is its very own world, of course. So that was for 3 years, and that was really just such a huge learning curve for me, but so interesting. And I met many, many, you know, big miners, small miners, explorers, prospectors, the lot. And many of them said to me, why don't you go out on your own consulting? Because we are trying to do all these native title and heritage negotiations throughout WA, but we need someone on the ground for us, and somebody who has an understanding of Aboriginal people, who's grown up with them, who knows how the land systems work. And they said, we'll give you work. And so I again jumped, set up my own consultancy, and then for the next 11 years or so, maybe 12 years, consulted right through WA. And at the same time, I'd met my husband, and he was in wine. So you couldn't have anything more geographically apart than my husband in Margaret River in the wine industry, me travelling up to the Pilbara and the Kimberley and out to, you know, Cal and the like. But it worked. It gave me lots of flexibility, and we did lots of really good work, because I wanted, my whole goal was to, I know it sounds a bit corny, but win-win outcomes. These negotiations on the land involving all these different stakeholders had to be respectful and had to get outcomes that everyone could live with, and that the Aboriginal groups, the native title groups, were happy with. And they had some tough rep bodies representing them. So they again, were usually very tough negotiations, but we did some good work. So that was great. And then I got headhunted again, and this time to take on the role as general counsel for right prospecting, which is
talking about some of the real heavyweights, as you know. Yeah. I mean, you're in the deep end there now, right?
Totally. I've gone from consulting to inside a very old WA family mining company, partner to Hancock, but Hancock and Wright were in dispute over the division of the assets of Peter Wright and Lang Hancock. And so they brought me in to head up basically an in-house legal team for Wright Prospecting. So that's what I did until about 2017. So it was about six and a half years, and I built an in-house team. And one of the things I'm really proud of is that as a female lawyer and having started in the 80s in law, I've experienced firsthand the misogyny and just how tough it is being a female, especially a young female in the world of law. Law is adversarial, it's combative, there's no place for wimps. And so there are a number of really, really smart young lawyers, female lawyers in top tier law firms in Perth. And so many of them had hit that glass ceiling and were unhappy and thinking about leaving the law. And happily, many of them came onto my team. And so we built this team, which was fabulous. And, again, it reminded me a little bit of Chandler, because we did spend a lot of time flying between Sydney and Melbourne, but particularly Sydney, and we had a lot of High Court matters. So it's been a big adventure. It's still going. The thing I'm most proud of is that the team I put together all those years ago are still there. I did my bit, and then for a number of reasons, mostly because my father was dying, we decided it was time to come back to ours. But my team is still there and still working, which is wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, again, those two enormous families in the West Australian mining landscape, I'm not sure they'll ever settle all of their disputes, but it keeps the courts busy anyway. You've jumped the gun there a little bit, Tanya, because I'm just about up to the part where you feel the calling to head back to the Northern Territory. And I suppose looking at your books, An Alice Girl, Beyond Alice, Alice in Prague, the common thread through all of that is Alice. So it's fitting, I suppose, that that you are back there, and that's where you've sat down and written most of your work. So we'll take another break. After that, I'll get you to go through the shift back to where it all began. This is Inspiring Stories. Tanya Heaslett is our special guest. Back with more in just a moment.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. Inspiring Stories for Bowra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.
Welcome back to Inspiring Stories. We are hearing some of the many adventures of author Tanya Heaslip. If you want to know more, she's got three fantastic books, An Alice Girl, Beyond Alice, and Alice in Prague. Now, Alice Springs, the town that that you grew up near, Tanya, yes. It lured you back in the last few years. Tell us why.
My father got cancer, really horrible bone cancer, and he was fading fast. And he, as I said earlier, he was a very astute businessman. He'd built up commercial properties as well as cattle properties, and he wasn't able to manage it all because he was sick. And it just felt like the right time to go home, that perhaps I could use that law for something useful to assist him. And it also felt like the right time to leave Wright Prospecting. I'd given 6 years, and that was a 24/7 role, and I felt like I'd done there everything that I could, and I'd set up the team. So we moved back to Alice, and there was something profoundly joyous for me about doing the full circle of returning to where it all began. I'd never properly lived back in Alice since I left at age 12 to head off to boarding school and then to law school, and I'd always travelled. And in part it was because I didn't know what I'd do back there. But the time felt right. We moved back in that red land, those beautiful red ranges.
Rocky was the
ranges.
All that you remembered it being?
Yeah, it was everything. Mind you, I'd come, no matter where I lived, I flew back to Alice between one and three times a year minimum, spent all my wages on airfares because I was forever homesick for that land. Mm. And, I mean, luckily the Pilbara places in the west filled that need to a certain extent, but there was nothing like flying home. And then knowing I could stay, I'd always gone home and then had to leave, but this was coming home. And so I took over Dad's businesses and worked with him up until he died, which was a really long and horrible process. But it felt very good to be able to do that and to bring all my life skills, the commercial, legal, strategic skills that I'd learned along the way in the corporate world and from travelling, to assist the family. But then I also thought, this is my chance to record these stories that I'd been wanting to record for so long. Now, Alice to Prague, I'd been working away at that for about 15 years, the whole time I started it in the West. I started in Margaret River, actually. Mm. And then I just kept working on it, and I received constant rejections. I'd send it out and it would get rejected. But when I got home, I thought, right, this is the time. And I found a fantastic publisher, well, Alan and Unwin, who said to me, look, what people really are interested in, most readers in Australia, because they live on the East Coast, is what the Outback's really like. So that's the story people really want to read. So I ended up getting a two-book deal, which is every author's dream, and I couldn't believe my luck. But that first book I then reworked worked, so that it was all about growing up in Alice, going to Prague, a bit of a compare and contrast with all the stories of Prague and the love affair and just the beauty and the magic of that world. And then that led me to my second book, An Alice Girl, which was about growing up in Central Australia up until age 12. And that's because my publisher had said, look, you think Central Europe is exotic, but again, for most people on the East Coast, Central Australia is just as exotic. So that story I wrote, full of, you know, yarns and stories of all the characters that I'd grown up with in School of the Air and the amazing times that I had. And it finished at 12 when I had to go to boarding school, which was a huge absolute wrench. All bush kids got sent away because there was no secondary school option available to us in the bush, and the territory government paid a subsidy to send, you know, bush kids away. So we knew we had to go, but boarding school was like going to Mars. Mm-hmm. Coming out of the freedom of the bush, you know, jeans and boots being the daily uniform to a tunic and tie and stone walls, concrete bells, rules. That was incredibly difficult. And what happened was, after I wrote An Alice Girl, a lot of people then contacted me and said, we went to boarding school during the 60s and 70s as well. We really want to read that story. So I went back to Alan Unwin and said, would you let me write that story? And they said yes. So the third book, Beyond Alice, is a combination of the boarding school years with lashings of outback holiday adventures and teenage romances and all the wonderful things that happen during your coming of age years. So that's what that third book represents. And it's amazing. I think all the years working under pressure to deadlines enabled me to write really three books in 3 years, which I, given I'm still working full time,
that's pretty good.
I haven't slept. I feel like I haven't slept for years. That's what it feels like.
You've got a bad toughness instilled in you then, that's for sure.
I think so. There were a number of times I thought, this is ridiculous. I cannot do that. And then I remember Dad always said, you cannot give up. You cannot give up pushing the cattle back to the dam. You can't get halfway and give up, because you will perish and the cattle will perish. You've got to get them back to water so they can be drafted and marketed and, you know, trucked off to market. So we grew up with this, you can never give up, because if you just can't. It was never an option. And Dad also used to say there's no such word as can't. So every time I thought, I don't think I can do this, I remember Dad and you can't give up. Getting the mob halfway back to the dam.
Yeah. Well, what's next then? You've got three books in pretty quick succession. There's no doubt this enduring fascination with outback life. What's your next book going to be about?
I've got I've got a number of ideas in mind, but I think I've got two books in mind I really want to do. The first is still about the Czechs, because I still have this enduring love affair for the Czech Republic, and I'm really interested in this question of dispossession and what it means to lose your home if you're forced to flee, and then how do you make a home in two places and how do you sort of reconcile that. I've got a lot of stories from Czech people living in Australia that I've met that I'd like to weave together. But the other one I'm thinking about is fiction. I was thinking, you know, young female lawyer in the desert, and there'll be some mystery or some thriller, and it will no doubt involve the mining industry and probably cattle stations as well. I think it'll just all come in there. So that's what I'm thinking for the moment. But with work taking up most of my time, it's still in the formative stages.
Percolating.
Yeah, percolating.
A joy to read once it is on the shelves. Tanya, thank you so much for your time. Some amazing adventures. And if you want to learn more about Tanya Heaslip's many adventures around the globe, particularly in the outback of Australia, and Alice Girl, Alice in Prague, and Beyond Alice, thank you so much for your time and being part of Inspiring Stories. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim. I've loved every minute of it.
Excellent. Thank you. You've been listening to Inspiring Stories, brought to you by Barra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything. We look forward to you joining us again next time as we unearth another inspiring story.
You're listening to Inspiring Stories for Barra and O'Day. Don't miss out on the little moments, because the little things are everything.